This is an MPB Think Radio podcast. To hear previous shows, visit mpbonline.org or download the MPB Public Radio app to listen on your iPhone or Android phone on demand.
Do you drive a vehicle? Then you'll find autocorrect helpful, especially on Coach Charlie's Tip of the Week. Listen to our podcast with me, Coach Charlie Melton, on any podcasting platform or on the MPB Public Media app.
From MPB Think Radio, this is Money Talks. Kevin Farrell here with Dr. Nancy Lotter-Janderson, president of New Perspective, and Ryder Taft, portfolio manager at New Perspectives. They're both chartered financial analysts, and Ryder holds the Certificate Investment Performance Measurement from the CFA Institute. On Money Talks, we're here each week to answer your personal finance questions. Today, between your phone calls, we're going to be talking about ways to pay off your debt. We've got several different methods to discuss. You can also send an email to money at mpbonline.org. I'd like to remind you that usually can't get to the emails during the show, but be sure that you will get a personal response from Nancy and or Ryder to any email question that you send us. So good morning. Hope you're both doing well this morning. We talk about financial news in the news, and so Ryder, we'll give you first shot today.
Oh, interesting. So, of course, we were talking about Thanksgiving and what we're eating last week, and now we're talking about what we bought after Thanksgiving. So Black Friday, Cyber Monday, news is that these were, again, record-breaking years.
But I thought we were going into recession.
Well, here's the thing. It was also record-breaking flights and people boarding flights. So we're... You know, word is the economy is so bad, we just have to buy and go on trips to just get our mind off of how bad the economy is. Yeah, a little retail therapy for the nation. It's very interesting kind of seeing the shopping reports and kind of how things are changing. One change in Black Friday or Cyber Monday shopping is people are buying more using their phones. So people are just getting more comfortable doing that. And that means it's kind of easier to buy things. You can, because we're on our phones all the time. You see something on social media, if you can just start clicking and buying, once you're comfortable with that, you are in that buying trap. And that opens up the possibilities for more retailers, just because it's easier, I think, for a lot of small retailers to reach their target audience on social media. So it's just a changing landscape. So sometimes we talked all last month about how the large stores were running sales all month long, but possibly this is still important for smaller retailers. Possibly just the way we're changing our shopping habits, it's making it easier for those small retailers to have successful shopping days.
And it's making it easier for me to buy ridiculous things off of Instagram. I order them because I think that looks so cool.
And then you've been influenced.
I have. They come in the mail and I think, what did I do? Yeah.
I did that once. It was some sort of... like a cleaning glove that had little scrubby things on it so you could use, you know, with your hand. Anyway, it was on a slow boat to China. It took like 3 months to get there. And so that's one of my things. It seems like it's always some foreign company that when that seems to run those things. And my other thing is I don't mind shopping online, but on my phone the other day, Lego was having a sale. You know, I enjoy putting them together. And they're extremely expensive. So anytime I see that there's a sale – so I logged in and in my VIP Lego, you know, I'm all logged in and the phone would not let me scroll past like the first three items in the list of like 170 things. It kept.
So you just had to buy all three of those.
Actually,
you know what? This is what they have for me.
This was through.
This is the Kevin collection.
This was through Facebook. So but it was one of those where I felt like something was loading up. And I thought to myself, if I'm going to have to sit here and wait for this thing to load 173 items. And so I tried it a couple of times, but finally I got so frustrated with it. I'm like, oh, well, no Legos for me. So like I said,
write to Lego HQ and let them know.
Well, and maybe I'm being, you youngsters, stay off my yard. But an older guy like me, to me, I like doing online because a screen is obviously bigger than your phone. Sometimes, to me, there are limitations by the actual physical size of your phone when trying to shop.
Well, definitely there's a difference in the way it's presented on a mobile device. device versus on a laptop. Mm-hmm. And so it does look different.
And I mean, you did raise a real concern. The whole point of trying to get people to spend more money is you've got to reduce friction. You've got to reduce barriers. And so most of the time, having someone pop up on Instagram and all you have to do is tap is a great way to reduce barriers.
Before you can think twice about it.
Absolutely. You're already there. You just have to do one or two taps and boom, you're done. Being able to pay by putting your thumb on your phone, just dangerous. But at the same time, if there is a technical problem, like Kevin noted, it just – you think, oh, maybe I'll do it later, and then you just don't. Or you just think, you know what, not worth the trouble today. Maybe I'll – maybe not.
The other funny part is, so I was trying to log into the Lego VIP, and I had forgotten what it was. So I did the whole reset your thing. And I think your iPhone does this where they say, hey, here's a strong password. It's, you know, ZQ,
don't tell your password.
So usually I'm like, I'm not going to remember that one, so I'll not use it. And then I thought to myself, well, you know, I'll just use it because I'll have it remember this password in my phone. Well, I did that. But then, of course, when it wouldn't work, it would have been a hassle to go online to do it because I would have had to get another password for my VIP account. So anyway,
now you're being old man.
You kids stay off of my yard.
Yes. We've crossed the line.
We've crossed the line.
Anyway, so I'm needless to say, it was a little bit frustrating. And oops, sorry, Lego. I probably would have bought something, but I didn't buy anything. So, which I didn't buy anything on Black Friday or Cyber Monday. So.
If you're listening, Lego, now what is our address here? in care of
they're fun,
Kevin.
But they really are things are expensive.
I bought a pair of pants.
Okay,
much more practical.
Very nice. That's true.
Legos are practical.
Oh, really?
Yeah, they're good. So much fun.
They decorate your house when you're done.
Okay,
people have
it's good. Well, see again,
it's plastic. It's plastic.
So might your pants be.
But for an old man like me, I need all the mental stimulation I can get to stay sharp.
Mental stimulation, practical. Boom.
Anyway, let's move on from that. Nancy, what's on your mind?
Oh, my goodness. I have a horror tale, which is also a cautionary tale for our listeners.
Ooh, pay attention, folks.
So part of my task over Thanksgiving was to go down to the coast where I grew up and help my dad with some making sure he had the beneficiary set up appropriately on all of his CDs. He had two different banks. And so we thought they were set up appropriately on everything except one. And we went to this one large coast bank that's been there for a long time. I won't name names. And only to find out that they were not set up appropriately. And they would not let us put five names on as beneficiaries on a TOD, a transfer on death, or a pass on death, which the state of Mississippi allows you to have. And when you have that, that means it doesn't go through your will. As soon as something happens to the primary owner, you just present with a death certificate and it's dividing according to their wishes. And so we were told by the branch manager that that's not possible, that they had a new policy, they could only have four names. Total, we had five beneficiaries of my dad. That was six names. And I'm thinking, this is a technology problem. This is a big bank. I did not understand this. And so we had to rip all of the beneficiaries off the accounts. And so those accounts now have to go through this will of his, which I'm going to be the executor on, in order to make sure what happens, it happens according to his wishes. Then we go to the second bank. We're going to check these beneficiaries too. And bear in mind, the bank is open. There are several people in there. But there was only one person who could look up the beneficiaries. And she just left.
Oh, out to lunch.
She was out to lunch. So we were told, well, you can leave your name and number. And finally, they did call us back. And then we had to go back on Friday because even though they had all the names there, the percentages weren't what we asked for.
A Black Friday indeed.
Oh, my gosh. So this is all to say to our listeners on a regular basis. And the holidays, it's a good time to look around and say, who has been nice to me? Who came to visit me? Did I like your gifts? Am I going to leave you something when I am gone from this earth? But this is a good time for you to go to every place that you bank, that you have a banking account, a brokerage account, an investment account, your 401k, your IRAs, everything, and make sure the beneficiaries are what you want. Life changes. Things change. You can forget about it. We've had cases where ex-spouses inherited because somebody forgot to go back and make those changes. So once a year, review your beneficiaries. That's what we're doing in our office right now.
And you've highlighted that it's okay if it goes by the will. But the beneficiary designation, sometimes you can do something different from the will. Maybe you can designate a specific account to a specific person or a specific purpose. And it's also a lot quicker and more convenient because so many times people are especially concerned about, well, I know my son or daughter is going to need cash soon.
Exactly.
And folks will do all sorts of things where they kind of maybe give an account to their child and just say, oh, well, they're going to make good for their brother, but maybe they will, maybe they won't. I mean, your children are going to definitely get along to your face when we're talking about beneficiaries and stuff. But you just have to watch out and make sure. Sure, ownership, beneficiaries, your will are all aligned with what you really intend and with what you want the world to look like when you're not here.
You're listening to Money Talks. Our website, moneytalks.mpbonline.org, is one way to hear past broadcasts. You can also download the MPB Public Media app and listen on your iPhone or Android phone on demand to all the local MPB Think Radio programs. Kevin Farrell here with Dr. Nancy Lotcher-Janderson, president of New Perspectives, and Ryder Taft, portfolio manager at New Perspectives. We're ready to answer some personal questions for you. We've got some open phone lines. Also today, we're going to be talking about ways to pay down debt. If you'd like to join the conversation with a comment, a question, maybe you have a successful way of helping reduce your debt that you'd like to share with us, or if you have a personal finance question, email the show by sending it to money@mpbonline.org. So when we've had this topic of discussion before, we talked about the snowball and the avalanche method of paying off debt, and I guess they kind of go hand in hand because they're similar. And if I remember, the snowball method is you pay off the card with the smallest debt
first. You got it. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And make that snowball grow.
Right. Whereas the avalanche method, you pay off with the largest balance first.
The highest interest.
The highest interest rate. Yeah. That's it. Okay. And just any just kind of basic thoughts, Ryder, do you see one method preferable to the other, or do you think it depends on a person's particular circumstances?
It does depend on a person's circumstances and what those debts actually are. So the snowball method is great psychologically because if you have a handful of debts out there, a handful of credit cards, loans, et cetera, there's going to be one of them that's small. And you can knock that one out maybe today. Maybe it's going to take a few months, maybe a year or something. But you can knock that one out quickly or more quickly than the others. And that's going to provide a little bit of boost so you can say, you know, I can do it. So if you're really struggling under the kind of psychological weight of that debt, the snowball method can be super helpful. The avalanche method is really focused on let's make this the lowest dollar cost as possible by paying off the highest interest rate first, which may be a bigger debt, but in the long term aims to save you more money. Now, if you have a lot of debts that are kind of all similar interest rates, then it's not going to matter as much. You know, if you're paying off, if your highest interest rate is 8% and your next highest one is 7%, you know, it's not going to make a huge difference which one you pay off first if you have the same dollars going to them. So it does depend on the person and kind of how the debt is affecting them. And it does depend on what those debts actually are.
And I would challenge our listeners to actually find that interest rate that you're being charged. Most people cannot tell us when they come and sit down with us. Go find every statement, latest statement on every card that you have. What is the balance and what is that interest that you're paying? I think it's going to make your eyes pop out.
Mm-hmm. What about sort of combining? Maybe, you know, you work on the highest interest rate and when that gets paid off, then the lowest amount. I mean, I guess that could work if sort of combining the two methods. Any thoughts on that? I mean,
I think a comprehensive plan is going to involve more than just a single solitary rule, because not to try to make it too complicated today, but there are also debts with different terms and different requirements. And some may actually have really generous terms. Some may, for instance, student loans. You can go to forbearance. You can go onto different payment plans. You can check, you know, if your income is lower, then you may qualify for a lower payment. You may qualify for some forgiveness. If you are 2 years away from some forgiveness, there's no point in ramping up your payments on student loans. I'm not going to say there's no point, but in general, it might be beneficial to wait and get that forgiveness rather than trying to be aggressive about that repayment. So just the terms of the loans, the terms of the debts matter as well.
And not all debt is bad debt. Certainly your mortgage, because you need to have a place to live, and most mortgages have lower interest than what you will see on a credit card. Well,
watch
or
what
car
we say
loan.
Right now. Oh boy.
I know it's a little different now, but you usually have lower rates on those because those are secured loans and they're secured by real estate. So that's a place to live. I don't worry about that.
As long as you are making those payments.
Exactly.
Let's not miss that minimum. And of course, when we're doing any debt payment plan, don't miss a minimum payment on anything.
Right, but
we're talking about directing your extra money. Sorry.
Exactly. Don't sacrifice your mortgage payment to make a payment on the credit card. That's ridiculous. Car loans, even though we're starting to see higher rates on those car loans, if that reasonable car, not some fancy sports car, but that reasonable car gets you to your job, then that's an investment in producing more income. So don't worry about that.
But a good point that you don't, it's because you're working on, you know, debt A and the snowball method, that doesn't mean that you just can forget about debts B, C, D, and E. You, as you mentioned, at least pay off the minimum of everything and concentrate your extra efforts on either the low balance or the high interest rate, whichever method you choose or whatever plan you've come up with. Let's go to the phones. We will start in Jackson. Charles has called in with a comment for us. Good morning, Charles. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Good morning. How's everybody doing?
Doing well.
What do you have for us?
Well, you know, I was listening to the conversation about credit card debt and did a quick look, and it said that as November 22nd or 23rd of this year, the credit card debt, and you may have already covered this, and I just missed it. The credit card debt was like $995 billion in this country. And it says that the average debt is like $6,008.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'd be wondering about why would people charge that much on credit cards? And Nancy, you mentioned like the high interest rate.
Because
the question that I wonder is that, does that mean that people in this country, that everybody just scraps so hard financially because of how...
Yeah. I'm going to say it's just easy. It's easy, Charles. And, you know, Ryder just talked at the top of the show about people traveling and spending, what our retail numbers are. It's not that we're so strapped at this point because most people are working and wages have gone up. It's because we've gotten so comfortable with, well, we just want to get what we want when we want it. And it's so easy to plunk down that card and not think about the interest that you are accumulating, which we now see those average rates are around 21%. And we've had several callers of the last few weeks calling in with cards at almost 30%. So when we work with people who get into some sort of financial problem, we can bet it's going to be related to credit cards almost all of the time. And the inability to really control that consumer debt and control your impulses. And if there's something that you want, save for it. Or if you have to put it on a card, pay it off in a very short order.
Okay, so this is something that I was looking at last night and trying to do some research on. So let's just kind of round some numbers off. There's $1 trillion in credit card debt, and they measure this kind of at a moment. Right. At today, there is $1 trillion in credit card debt. That's a good round number. Now, there is about $14-15 trillion of consumer spending. Just because there's this credit card debt, we think, oh my goodness, this is terrible. This is a massive amount that people owe. Yes, but that also includes the people who pay their credit cards off every month. It doesn't mean that this is $1 trillion accruing interest at 30%.
But when you're talking about average household debt, it's at over $6,000, that yes. is revolving. It is not being paid off every month.
Some of it is. And household, so debt service payments, so the amount of our household income that goes towards paying off all sorts of debts, it's not high, it's not low. It's been lower. It's, you know, it's about where it was in 2019. 2020, it dropped down a lot because people paid off cards. People weren't putting as much on cards. And it's kind of bounced back up. Part of that's a lot, you know, due to mortgage increases and then interest rates on credit cards. But if you think about just the amount, it would be purely possible. It's very hard to get information on this because the credit card industry is so spread out. There's thousands of banks issuing credit cards. There's non-bank entities. You can get them from stores. You can get them from a community bank. You can get them from a huge bank. So it's really hard to get that information. It's easy to get the debt information, but it's hard to get how many people are actually carrying that balance over month to month. But for instance, if everyone put every single dollar of consumer spending on a credit card, they don't. Like, let's be clear, they don't. And everyone paid all of it off, you would expect us to have about $1 trillion worth of credit card debt. Now, that being said, that is absolutely not what is happening.
No.
But again, when you see that $1 trillion level, it is not the same thing as saying we have $1 trillion in student loans or however many $1 trillion in mortgages. It does not mean that that is not money that's just paid off. And then, of course, put back on, of course, the next month. But it does not mean that that is interest bearing. It does not mean that that is burdensome. So that top line number, it's fascinating, but it does not tell us nearly what we need to know about credit card debt problems.
Let's go beyond that to still say that we do know average household balances are going up. And that happens when people get very comfortable and certainly feel like I've got a job, I can spend, I can do what I want to do.
But so is spending.
Yes. Yes.
My credit card balance this month is much higher than last month.
Well, you
but
traveled.
I'm still going to pay it off. Right.
But
so again,
I'm
that balance,
to
that
you,
top line number. I mean, again, we still have the same advice to any individual with credit card debt. Absolutely pay that off. Yeah, absolutely. And yes, some of the increase in credit spending is interest bearing balance burdensome on households. But again, that top line number, it is a thrilling and a shocking number. But it does not tell us nearly what we need to know to assess the situation in individual households.
All right, Charles, good call. Thanks for the call. And I would say, as someone who has struggled with credit card debt in the past, that one, when you start building up credit debt, you then need to use credit cards to pay for the things because you don't have the money because you're paying off credit cards. My other thing, too, is it was easy for me to just not pay attention to the amounts the totals.
Yeah.
And Nancy, like you said, I think one of the things that helped me finally get on the road to recovery, as it were, was probably on your suggestion, I went back and said, oh, gosh, look, I've got a lot more debt than I really thought I did.
You don't realize. And we can play that credit card game of, well, we'll use this card now. And now so many even utilities will take our credit cards as payment. So you can rack up just regular fixed expenses that just ordinary living expenses on those cards because you've gotten carried away and you don't have the excess to deal with it directly.
Money Talks is MPB Think Radio's personal finance broadcast. Kevin Farrell here with Dr. Nancy Lottridge-Anderson, president of New Perspectives and Ryder Taft, portfolio manager at New Perspectives. They're both chartered financial analysts. Ryder holds the Certificate Investment Performance Measurement from the CFA Institute. We're ready for your personal finance questions this morning, also talking about ways to pay down debt. We've got a caller on the line. It's Lisa has called in this morning with a question about refinancing a car. What do you have for us, Lisa?
Hey, how you doing?
Good
morning. I kind of got in a situation, not unbeknownst to me, actually, with my grandson and my daughter, and I ended up helping them buy a car for his graduation. And I found out once I got all the paperwork in the mail that I was the sole owner.
Oh, wow.
The interest is extremely high. The, you know, like in 4 months, we've really only made one actual car payment. All the rest has been interest.
When
I really looked at it online.
What is the interest rate?
Would you believe like 27%?
Oh, my goodness.
I
want to refinance.
Stories.
Yeah, I want to refinance, but we're just now starting to get close to paying on it for 6 months. And I don't know how long I should wait or try to refinance it. I am a senior citizen, and, you know, I don't want to get straddled with this if something happens with my grandson's job and things like that.
So, quick question. You said you were the sole owner. Are you the sole owner of the car or just the only person responsible for paying the debt?
It looks like I'm the sole owner of the car because I had to go get the title and everything,
okay.
And the insurance had to be put in my name, too.
Okay, that's interesting because if it is a car that your grandson is driving and is treating like his, ultimately it sounds like the goal is to move that into his name. One thing you mentioned, so he just graduated and he does have a job now. It's possibly going to be easier for him to get financing, which would look like it's a transaction between the two of you. It would look like he's purchasing it from you. When you want to look at refinancing a car, there are places I've seen online that will refinance a car, but I would start with your local bank or local credit union. I have seen those, one, be most willing to refinance a car, because refinancing a car is kind of a weird transaction, but I've seen local banks and local credit unions being most willing to refinance a car. Also, they're typically going to have the best rates. Car interest rates are high, but they should not be 27%. 27% is a car loan for someone who has zero credit and can't prove their income. You mentioned you're a senior citizen. I don't know if you have Social Security. You at least can demonstrate that you have consistent income. And the great thing is your grandson can probably start demonstrating that he has consistent income, even if it's not super high. So I would look both of y'all inquire about he's going to ask his bank financing places about purchasing a used car, because again, it's going to look like he's purchasing from you. And then you're going to ask your bank about, or credit union, about refinancing a car. I do strongly believe you can and should get rates much better than that 27%. I understand that is painful right there.
Right. And that's through a well-known online banking company, which I won't mention, but
sure.
You know, it is through one of them. And my daughter really kind of got, she's never bought online before. You know, they had all these different kind of companies that sell these cars online.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what it was. It was a purchase buy kind of thing, deliver it to the house kind of thing, you know.
Yeah, it's real convenient when you're clicking those buttons, isn't it?
Yeah. And you know, when everything was sent to me online, I'm not real good with online business. Usually my daughter is sitting with me and we can read through it together. And the spots I thought I was signing was co-signer spots, but it was just the signer of the loan and everything. So, you know, and then when I got the papers FedEx to me and I really was able to hold something in my hand and go over it, I was like, I'm the sole owner of this car, you know. And I was just in a state of confusion and shock there and really fussing at my daughter. But anyway, that's past news. So I just wanted to make sure. And you said I can, you know, because my grandson's only 18. So he's young. So I didn't know if I could sell it to him as a used car. Maybe he could go through his financial institution at 18 years of age.
Yeah, it may not be easy, and it may be too difficult for him, because I don't know, again, is if he is actually going to be able to get good, reasonable rates, and two, if the purchase price is reasonable for him getting financing. You know, that is absolutely an avenue I would pursue, because again, that's getting it in his name. That is getting it kind of where it needs to be. Of course, you got to think about what are his insurance rate's going to be, of course, him as the driver. It's still going to be a high insurance rate, because that is another cost of having a car, is that insurance maintenance, gas, all those things.
And I do like Ryder's idea of checking with the credit union. If your grandson is employed somewhere where they have a credit union, the advantage there is often the payments for the car can be taken out of the paycheck. So that means it's more likely for him to get an approval for that.
And he's not going to miss a payment, hopefully.
Yes.
Right. And I mean, he pays his pay. He gives me all the money for the car note, which is extremely high, $5-something a month for an 18-year-old. Plus, he pays his almost $300 a month insurance. So, you know, I mean, it's not like he's had a job only making $8 or $10 an hour because he does weld. So, he's in the state of Mississippi, you know, welding kind of pays pretty good. So, but, I appreciate y'all's information. I really needed to know that. And I thank you so much because it's been worrying me. And on my mind, I didn't even know if I could even do a refinance under, you know, a year or something like that. But I'll check into it with my credit union as well.
Good luck, Lisa.
All right, Lisa. Thanks for the call. Let's stay on the phone lines here and go to South Haven. John has called in today. Good morning, John. You're on the air.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I have a rather complicated question, but the answer may be simple. Can a surviving spouse make a contribution to the other person's existing IRA? The other person had income and already has an existing IRA, but passed away during the year, and their surviving spouse will file a joint tax return. And what I'm trying to find out is if they can make a contribution to the deceased spouse's IRA before they make it their own.
Well, it makes sense that you would be able to, since that person did have income during the year, and as long as the joint filers do qualify based on the amount of income, whether they can do a traditional IRA or a Roth IRA. But certainly you should check with your CPA, because most contributions to IRAs that we work with people, they're often in arrears. So maybe, you know, you're making a contribution in April for the previous year. So I think you should still be able to do that.
So one complication, that's a very interesting question, yeah. I find. One one possible workaround, of course, you haven't said everything about the situation, is that if, say, you have a spouse who earned, you know, $10,000, therefore eligible to make an IRA contribution, you may be able to just make your own as a spousal IRA and not have to worry about contributing to a deceased person's account, because a custodian...
But if they're doing both, though.
Oh, for doing that. Okay, yes. I see how it would be important for your taxes. One complication being that once the custodian knows that person is deceased...
They may freeze the account.
They are... unlikely to allow a contribution. That would be another place I would check just to see if it's possible, because of course it does make sense, you know, and it's just a matter of, oh no, we made the contribution, you know, the check was coming after, you know, we always planned to make this contribution. It doesn't make sense that someone would be able to make it just because the timing of their death. So it seems like you should be able to.
Okay, well, we'll check with the CPA. It's hard. I've looked in the IRS computer and everything, and I cannot find an answer to that question.
Yeah, I would think that you can, because the deadline is, you know, it's the tax deadline. It's not like you have to do it, you know, when
the
money is earned or something like that.
Yeah.
So it seems like you could. Again, technical issue, will the custodian allow it? Which is why, you know, so we custody with Schwab. We have IRAs at Schwab. I would call Schwab and ask them that question, especially if they already know that they're deceased.
Okay. Thank you. I appreciate the information that you could find.
All right. We're glad you found our show, Money Talks. Kevin Farrell here with Dr. Nancy Lotridge-Anderson, president of New Perspectives, and Ryder Taft, portfolio manager at New Perspectives. You can email the show by sending it to money@mpbonline.org, and we're usually able to give you a response sometime off air via the email machine. So, you know, we talked about the snowball method, the avalanche method. We probably won't have a little time to go into, but you can do debt consolidation. There's balance transfer. There's a number of different vehicles that people can use to try to reduce their debt. But underlying all of this is you need to recognize what your spending patterns were, and you can't, if you built up a debt and you pay it off, you can't just do the same thing again, because you're liable to build up the debt again.
Exactly. So if you go to all the trouble to consolidate your debt and then you just keep going with opening up more credit card accounts, you're accomplishing nothing, and you've probably added to your expenses with all the stuff you're doing for debt consolidation.
So thoughts about the psychology behind it all? I mean, how do you think someone's kind of frame of mind should be when going into trying to pay off debt?
I think, like you said, identifying have things changed. And a lot of times you might see someone who says, okay, well, I accumulated the student debt because I was in college. That's not going to happen again if you're not enrolled in college or planning to. And maybe I incurred this credit card debt with moving expenses and it took me longer to find a job. And you can clearly point to the situation in which, you know, your physical situation in which you acquired the debt is a lot different from your actual situation now. I've got a paycheck. I've got my 401k going. I've got emergency savings. I can tackle this. So that's an easy one when you can identify just dollar-wise going in and out that there's a difference in your situation. But you mentioned psychological differences. That's a lot tougher. And I mean, I would also look for evidence in – you mentioned spending patterns. I would look for evidence there. Say, okay, well, have you reduced spending compared to your income at all? Have you really gotten out of those – you know, if you racked up that debt because you just ate out all the time, well – are you still eating out all the time? And not just, oh, I haven't eaten out in the past week, but have you really truly changed that habit?
And we do know that some people, just like any kind of addiction, they can have a spending addiction. There's a rush to buying something new. Also, we run into people who, you know, they rack up debt because they're so intent on being the person to support their whole family, you know, help everybody else out and cover all of their expenses. And that becomes part of their psychology. And so you often just have to hit rock bottom and say, I can't do this anymore. I can't manage it anymore. And I have to change.
And again, from my personal experience, one thing that was somewhat easy for me to do would be like, oh, well, I'm just using the credit card this month for whatever. Mm-hmm. And then the next week it's like, well, this is just the one thing that I'm using it for this month. And so I would say if you are trying to maybe get a handle of what your spending patterns are to try to, change that in the future would be to have some sort of system online on paper or something where you can't just say to yourself, well, this is just the one-time credit card, because when you do the one-time credit card 5-6 times throughout the month, that's
when
you
begin
to build.
Yeah.
Well, and I will say to you, it has been a joy to work with somebody as they work this down, if they're really diligent, because what usually happens is they realize how much money they have once they clear out this consumer debt. They really are fine. They have enough to live on and live a good life, and they're not worried about debt collectors all the time.
Let's get one final call in for the hour, and we'll talk to Tan, who calls us today. Good morning. You're on the air with us. Go ahead.
Hello, everybody. I just wanted to ask about capital gains tax. If we sell a house and we two questions in reference to capital gains. If we sell a house and we have a large income that comes in from that, would that be taxed at the same tax rate that we currently have? And secondly, if we sell a house and we want to buy another house that's a similar cost, would it be a taxable event? And third, if we decided to buy a house in a different country, would it be taxed the same way as it would be in the United States?
Well, the first thing is, this house that you're talking about, was that your primary residence?
Yes.
Okay, if it's your primary residence, you are exempt from a capital gains up to $250,000 for an individual, $500,000 for a couple. And so for most people, when you sell that primary residence, you really don't have enough of a capital gains to even worry about taxes on that. You can put it in your pocket. You can turn around and buy another house. Yes, you can buy another house in another country, but you're going to be subject to their tax laws at that point.
The second question you asked, if you are selling a house, could you buy one of a similar value? So there is without incurring taxes, there is a way. It's called a 1031 exchange.
But that doesn't happen.
Not
for a primary residence.
Right, not for your residence. So again, if we're talking about, say, like an investment property, and you sell one you identify a similar one. You have to go through a very specific process, and that generally involves identifying the property to purchase before you even sell the old one. So that is possible. That's kind of when you get into real estate investment. That is an interesting topic there. But of course, what you end up doing is you end up with a more and more valuable home with lower and lower cost basis. So you do have to watch out if you ever do sell them. You're just having more taxes there. Did we address that the capital gains tax rate is indeed lower than your income rate?
Yeah, but I do still want to emphasize we do have this huge tax break for a primary residence. If it's a house you're living in and you sell it, if you have a gain on that for less than $250,000 for an individual, less than $500,000 for a couple, there is no capital gains tax to pay.
Super important there. And then you mentioned buying in a foreign country. The tax rules, if you bought and then sold a house in a foreign country, are indeed the same. Now, the reporting is that may not be being reported to the IRS. Well, a lot of home sales aren't going to be reported to the IRS, but it is the responsibility of the individual taxpayer to faithfully and accurately report.
And you may have additional taxes
in that other country. Yeah.
Yes.
That's right.
All right, that's going to wrap us up. Thanks for the call. Money Talks is a production of MPB Think Radio, funded in part by generous financial support from listeners. To hear today's show or previous show, you can visit moneytalks.mpbonline.org or listen to the podcast by searching for Money Talks. So for Dr. Nancy Lotridge-Anderson and Ryder Taff, I'm Kevin Farrell, inviting you to join us every Tuesday at 9 for Money Talks. It's heard only on MPB Think Radio.
This is an MPB Think Radio podcast. To hear previous shows, visit mpbonline.org or download the MPB Public Radio app to listen on your iPhone or Android phone on demand.